thank you all for joining us. On your screen is an indication of the collaboration that is kind of working behind the scenes to put this on, along with a great deal of other assistance from folks out of the private industry and other universities across the country. My name is John Newkirk. I'm director of the Western Center for Risk Management Education. Our series, as those of you who have joined us before know, is that we're trying to bring information to help producers and others meet the challenges of today's uncertain economy. And in agriculture, unfortunately, in some sectors, it appears a bit more uncertain today than it did 5 months ago. And so this morning, families facing uncertainty in ag. And I'll have to say, for this series, we are, as we have with the others, are really fortunate to have a really well-qualified and excellent set of presenters. This morning, we have two presenters. There will be an opportunity for questions after each presentation. There we will pull some polling questions on that we'd like you to respond to give us some feedback and some information. And after both presenters, there will be an opportunity for question and answer for both presenters. I'll give just a bit more introduction in a minute, but we're really pleased to have Dave Gaylor from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and also Jay Gordon, who's the executive director of the Washington Dairy Federation. In the chat window to your left of this larger screen, you see a little narrow window towards the bottom of that. That's where you type in your questions. You bring that in. Our team will consolidate if there are similar questions, and then I will present them, give them to the presenter. And here you see where you do that. Also, type in here if you're having some kind of technical difficulty, audio or other. We've been able to solve 98% of the technical issues, but this is an imperfect technology. Is still evolving and developing. The biggest one that we have not been able to solve for some folks is the audio, and normally that is associated with bandwidth on their end. But if you have a technical question, please type it in there, and our team will get back to you often on the side and communicate with you. If you've missed our past webinars, they're all on the Ag and Uncertain Times webpage. At the end of the program, we'll have a file up there that it's really easy for you to download to your computer that has all of these links. The June series around credit issues, the September series around marketing, some excellent presentation and resource materials in both of those. So what's coming next? Next Wednesday, where do we want to go? We've got Elaine Fraze is actually from Canada, is an exceptional communicator around communications issues, is part of a farm operation herself, so she understands the issues firsthand. We also have Jeff Trunell from Colorado State University, who's done a lot of work with farm and ranch families, and Mike Roseman, who is a clinical psychologist whose work is around working ag wellness for farm families. Then on the 20th, the whole session will be focused around bankruptcy. The 21st, a kind of a wrap-up session. And all of those start at the same time as this. There is another very valuable resource out there. It's the mitnet.extension.org, in which folks from extension system all over the country are contributing information, a real wealth of things around farm and ranch families, as well as family and other issues. So full screen button toggles. If you want to see just the slide presentation, you can toggle back and forth on that. So from time to time, And we're going to do a few polling questions right now. And this is really simple for you to respond to. Just take your mouse up there and click on the answer that fits. It's been interesting. We've seen some shifting and moving of where our audience is from series to series. That helps us to know whether our information is getting out and who it's getting out to. So you can help us if you just very quickly move your mouse up there, click on the right response there. And we've got a great audience this morning. Our numbers continue to grow here as people are signing on. So we have another question here. So how are you connected to today's seminar? Vote on that. What is your primary occupation? We've had a spectrum of people. We've had lenders. We've had folks from the supply, ag supply industries, from commodity organizations, a big group of extension educators, some folks out of the not-for-profit, and other governmental agencies. It's been a mix. We've tried to target our information about the series broadly, and so it's been good to see that we've had a group. Here's one. How many producers are experiencing financial stress have you worked with during your professional career? This is not the times that we're in. It's not the first time that we've seen declines in prices below the cost of production. Possibly a little more broader across industries this time around. So thank you for voting. Move to Dave Gaylor. And I've had the privilege, and I say that, and it's been a real learning experience to me to work with Dave for the last 7 or 8 years. And actually, during one of the last downturns here in the state of Washington for both the apple industry and our dairy industry, we set up something called the Farm Family Support Network and invited Dave out to work with us in the very beginning and help set that up. But because of his experience starting in the 80s working with farm families, Dave is the deputy director of the North Central Risk Management Education Centers, one of our close partners and collaborators in the whole risk management education area. He began his career in 84, right kind of in the midst of that 80s farm crisis. And I invite you to go at the webpage and look at his background. Contact Dave on the site if you've got questions. He's got a wealth of experience, very practical experience, because he and his high school sweetheart, Cindy, who is an exceptional photographer, are involved in their family farming operation with Dave's brother, father, and mother in northeast Nebraska, and corn, soybeans, and kids. So, Dave, without further ado, kind of set the context for us this morning. It's the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, John. Well, let me tell you a little bit more about who I am. As John said, my wife is a photographer. One of the things that she's taken a picture of is me driving my combine right there. So I also have some background in production agriculture. But let me tell you a little bit more about what I've done in my professional career. For the last about 10-plus years, my position at the university, prior to my becoming deputy director here at the Risk Management Education Center, my position has been a transition specialist. So that means that I work with farm and ranch families that are kind of in three stages of their careers. I work with folks that are just getting started in farming. I work with people that are looking at doing estate planning, trying to pass the business down to the next generation. And the third area that I work with is folks that are having financial problems, and some of them are considering transitioning out. This is my contact information, and I'm more than happy to visit with any of you either through email or by phone or whatever, so feel free to use that if this is helpful at all. As John said, I'm in the north central area of the United States, that kind of a flesh-colored 12-state area in the Midwest, known for, I guess you might say, plows and cows and sows. We do produce roughly half of the nation's agricultural commodities, so we do have a lot of production agriculture here. And I'm bringing from that perspective a little bit, maybe different slant than that you might be seeing out there on the West Coast. Historically, I want to tell you a little bit more about what I have done so that you can get an idea where I'm coming from. As John mentioned early, I started working at the university in 1984, and we had a program called Managing for Tomorrow. Excuse me. We had a program that ran for about 4 years during the 80s, and we worked with approximately 800 farm families during that time. Since that time, we've also done legal and financial clinics. I do about 30 to 35 of these a year, and they're free financial clinics. I also do them with an attorney, and we try to set aside an hour to 2 hours per family to talk about any issues that the families might want to discuss. And you know, we see all kinds of situations coming in there. Probably work with 300-400 operations a year. And I just have to say, all the way from the 80s through the 90s and the early part of the 2000s, that we've always had some producers that are experiencing financial problems, having financial stress. You know, our agricultural sector is not any different than folks in ordinary life. There's always problems, health issues, financial issues, marriage issues, whatever it might be, that can contribute to having financial problems. But, you know, I don't really want to say that we're in the 1980s again, but I would also like to say that we have definitely seen an increase in folks that are having financial problems here just in about the last year. And in our area of the Midwest, we're seeing probably a heavier concentration in the dairy industry and the hog industry, the livestock feeding industry. The crop end of things, which would amount to corn and soybeans mostly in our part of the United States, we're starting to see some issues there as well, but predominantly it's been in the livestock sector, at least in the last little bit. I was asked to comment about what we saw in the 80s, and you know, some of you have gone through the 80s, and some of you maybe have not. For those of you that have not, let me just give you a little rundown. You know, we had experienced a kind of a rapid increase in farm asset values and ag asset values during the late 70s, early 80s, first year or two in the 80s in particular. And then we started to see kind of the opposite occur. We saw asset values that basically plummeted in the Midwest. Land values that probably peaked out in 81 that dropped 50 to 75% by 86, 87. At the same time that was going on, we saw really high interest rates. Ordinary interest rates 16 to 18%, default interest 22, even maybe higher in some cases. So we had a situation quite a lot different than what we see now, where the asset values had plummeted, interest rates were high. Cash flows were tight. They certainly weren't good, but we didn't have as much of a cash flow issue, more of a collateralization issue. Many producers were, you know, basically insolvent if you looked at those reduced asset values. And if a lender would look at a liquidation, the result was that not only would the farmer or rancher have a virtually a zero net worth or maybe even an insolvent situation, but it translated into lender problems. And so we had several banks, a couple of farm credits that actually folded during that time. And had it not been for Chapter 12 that came in, I believe it was in 87, and FSA shared appreciation agreements, I'm not sure what would have really turned this around, but that did make quite a difference. 2009, you know, our situation's quite a lot different. We have asset values that have softened a little bit, but not a great deal. We have low interest rates, but what we have in our situation now is we literally have a world financial crisis that we've possibly bottomed out on and are turning around. And you couple with that financial crisis, you couple with that a volatility in cost of inputs and a volatility in the prices or value of production sold, and there's been a lot of producers that have really been caught in a squeeze. And in our part of the United States, it's probably caught more livestock producers than anything. So what's resulted is a cash flow that is literally terrible. We have many situations, hog producers, dairy producers, that are maybe not even covering cost of feed, let alone covering a lot of those other kinds of variable costs and some of the fixed costs. So we have a really serious situation right now. A lot of producers still have some equity, but they're really looking at a tough decision. Another thing that's a little different now than what we had in the 80s is we have a lot of folks that are coming up with a lot of credit card debt. I think our record for credit card debt is just under $250,000 for one farming operation, a little over 30 credit cards to do that. So it's another variable that hasn't really been involved, that wasn't involved so much in the 80s. And I'll just make one little comment there. We've run across quite a few what I would call credit counseling scams, and there's been a lot of that kind of thing starting to pop up, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. So what we're facing now is farmers are looking at a decision, ranchers, dairymen are looking at a decision. In many cases, do we try to preserve this equity? Just for an example, I worked with a dairy last week. They had about $500,000 worth of equity, but they were losing $1,500 a day on their cash flow. And so their decision is, do we try to preserve this $500,000 of equity, or do we roll the dice and decide that if the market would turn around, that we've got a chance to make this back and indeed maybe make a handsome profit if this ever comes back. So we have a lot of producers that are looking at this right now. I have a little comment here about my drowning man. People in stress, the way I kind of think about people that are having financial stress is, if you can envision a man drowning, floundering in a pool of water, deep water, you know, if something floats by, that individual's going to grab onto that and he's going to hang on for dear life. And we have a lot of people that are really in that situation right now. They're drowning. They don't know where to go. They don't know what to do. And so, you know, we have to be careful as educators or people that are working with folks that are having problems that we don't allow them to bring us down and drown with them. And it's a real caution. I just say that going in. Lessons that we learned from the 80s. One of the big lessons that I personally learned is that the role of the extension professional, or the role of person working with producers, is different when you're working with someone that's having financial stress than it is maybe in a typical extension situation. You know, we many times are looked at as the expert. Someone comes in and they have a weed that's been bothering their lawn, or they have a insect that's been a problem, and we're looked at as the expert, and we give the advice. We tell them exactly what to do. But I guess I would really caution you not to try to become an expert in this area. I believe that we're more of a facilitator or a coach, that it's our job to, you know, gather the information, to get as much as we can, to try to put that pen in their hands, helping them to make decisions, helping them to identify their issues, look at their alternatives, and then see if we can help them make their solutions, their decisions to make their solutions. It's very good for the ego to be asked by someone, what should I do? If you were me, what would you do? And I'll guarantee you that you'll be asked that question. But I think we're at a point in time where by giving them that answer, telling them what to do, what you've done is you've floated by this drowning man, and they're going to hang on to you and look to you for all the answers. That's probably not a good long-term way to deal with it for them. If you can help them to develop the skills and help them to develop the decision-making, evaluating alternatives, it's my opinion that you'll be much more effective if you can help them by guiding them and coaching them and mentoring them and facilitating them through this process rather than giving them all the answers. So what I've tried to do is to list a little bit of kind of a process that I try to go through when I'm working with a family. And, it's very brief, but this might give you some ideas of how I work with families. I start off and an individual walks into my office or I'm sitting down with them. And I try to consciously spend some time in an introduction. And what I'm trying to do with that introduction of who I am is convey to them that I have experience, that I've worked in this area for quite a while, that I'm not the person with all the answers, but they can trust me to help them work it through, that what I'm doing with them will be confidential. I'm not going to be talking about it at the with people they might know or with other colleagues. It's confidential. And I usually like to start out with asking them a question, something like, well, what brings you in or how can I help you? And after I ask that question, then I want to just shut up and see what they have to say. Many times that first thing that they have to say has very little to do with why they're actually in there. But what we're doing at this point is I'm starting to gather information, trying to figure out what in the world's going on, not just facts and figures, but also the feelings and some of those underlying things that are really going to help people make a decision. Not just listening with my ears, but also watching what's going on, looking at the nonverbal interaction. There's many times it'll be a husband-wife or maybe a father-son. And if you watch that other person that's not doing the talking, you might gain as much information as you will from the person that's doing the talking. I think it's important to use all your senses and try to figure out what's going on here. I have a little item again about this pigeonholing. It's if you've done a lot of it, and it looks like quite a few of you have been involved with this for a while, it's very easy for me to start saying, oh, this looks like a problem that I saw in the guy last week or the guy last year or something, and this is how we work through this, so this is what you need to do. Just a word of warning, don't if you catch yourself doing that, try not to put people in that pigeonhole. What we're doing is gathering information. One of the questions that helps me to gather information is just asking things like, what's your lender telling you? Did you bring a balance sheet with you? How have you valued your assets? Do you have an income and expense, any income expense records, any tax records? Have you done a cash flow? And you'll start to get information as to what's going on with that situation. The expertise that I think we have as folks that are working with people in problems is not to tell them what to do, but to kind of work through this process and gather information, help them identify if there's something urgent. Maybe there's a deadline. Maybe there's a foreclosure coming up or a replevin action coming. Maybe there's a health issue or a housing issue, or maybe they're out of food, or maybe there's a mental health issue. It's help them identify what those urgent things are, And if there's not, if there's something urgent, we have to deal with it. If there isn't anything urgent, then we can move on to identify what the key issue might be. Do we have a financial solvency problem? Are we short of collateral? Are we simply not cash flowing? Or is the business not profitable? You know, we're going to use all those financial tools that are out there. We'll use some enterprise analysis, our cash flows, our balance sheets, trend sheets, so forth and so on. You know, maybe the issue is not financial at all. Maybe they've just lost credibility with their lender. But what we're trying to do is help this individual identify where the problem is, what the issue is. And then, you know, in Dick Hawkins' terms, those of you who maybe have been around a while, you know, Dick Hawkins always said, you help people identify where are you now, where do you want to be, and how are we going to get there? Well, once we identify where we are, then we have to look at where they're going to be. And when we look at the finish line, the where you want to be, to help people start getting a handle on this, we have to help them identify what's the first hurdle they have to get over to head toward that finish line. And I think that if we can do that, we can begin to get people a sense of, I am back in control of what's going on. So oftentimes people just don't know how to address it, where to go, and what to do. One of the other questions that I like to talk to folks about is basically prioritizing assets. Sometimes maybe one of the alternatives is to do some liquidation. Prioritizing those assets can help them think this through. Are the assets earning their keep? Are they actually paying the interest on what that loan might be against those assets? Well, after we've done a bit of that, then I think we move to helping them think about what their options are. Where do they go? What are their alternatives? And again, if we can help them to identify the options rather than putting the pen in our hand, put the pen in theirs, have them write down what they think their alternatives are, eliminate things that they absolutely won't consider, and then gather the information that needs to be gathered. Some of it we might have to help them gather. Some of that information we maybe have better access to than they do. But the more that they can do, I think the happier they're going to be with the decisions that they make. When we finish gathering information, I always like to talk about, all right, what's next? What do we have to do? What's that first hurdle? Who's responsible to make sure it's done, and when does it have to be done by? Go through things one more time with them, make sure they're set to go. Give them my contact information and when it is and when it's not appropriate to contact you. I'll tell you, those people will call at 11, 12 o'clock at night if you don't tell them after a certain time, don't call. And you know, if it really is urgent and they need to call me, fine, but there's times when you have to be careful of that too. What else can we do today? And then one of the last things I like to do just before they're walking out the door is ask them, how are you dealing with all this stuff? Are you sleeping okay at night? And then I usually tell them, you know, normal people that are under stress like you are going through experience all kinds of symptoms, including problems sleeping or maybe sleeping all the time. Sometimes there's alcohol abuse or marriage issues, very difficult making decisions. If we have a situation in Nebraska where we have some free mental counseling available, and it's really good to know what resources are available for you in your own state. But I always tell them that if they would like help discussing how other people deal with these tough times, that they can follow up with this free mental counseling. And I think that's been very helpful to a lot of them. I believe right now in Nebraska we have, if I remember my numbers, I think there's 2,600 farm operators, farm people in Nebraska that are currently using this free mental counseling, way more than we ever expected. One other note, and I'll just make that about you personally. I really find that I need someone to be able to talk to myself, so that it's very difficult not to take these problems home with me. I have an individual, that an attorney that I work with. He and I work hand in hand in a lot of these situations, and I really think be aware of that yourself, that it's important to have someone that you can diffuse with, someone that you can talk to, someone that you can confide in. You know, do it in a confidential way. You don't need to mention names, but it just gets to be a big load. And if you try to help folks work through some of these situations and aren't aware of it yourself, I think that you could end up paying a price that's pretty high yourself. With that, I'll just again put my contact information up. I'm more than happy to visit with any of you, and if you need someone to confide in and you don't have anyone, there's my office number, there's my cell number. Don't call after 6 o'clock at night. Other than that, that's pretty much concludes my remarks, John, and I'll pass it back to you.
Dave, thanks very much. One of the questions in from the audience is, what's the number one question you get when working with families?
I think I get asked almost every time, what should I do? What would you do if what would you do if you were me? You know, and I more or less always refuse to answer that directly. What I will come back is a question about, well, let's see if we can identify what your alternatives are. And, you know, if I choose the alternative that seems best to me, that's based on who I am and where my perspective is and what my background is. But I'm not going to go out there and manage this dairy for these people. I'm not going to go out there and live their life for them. So it's really important, I think, to help them make the decisions based on who they are, what's their situation, what their goals are. And I know they're going to be talking about goals. Probably Jeff's going to do that next week, but or next time. But, you know, we really need to think about where they're coming from and helping them to do that rather than me doing it for them.
And another member of our audience has asked, says, you pointed to one example of a dairy producer losing $1,500. Per day. And is this a average dairy amount that represents most dairy producers? Of course, we'll probably ask this.
Probably not. This was about a 500 cow dairy. You know, and just a little more about their situation. They had a lot of feed on hand, they were trying to decide what would it make most sense to run that feed through the existing dairy cows, or would they be better off doing something else with that feed? And so, you know, they were really facing a tough situation. Would that be typical? I would say, you know, I don't know. Maybe Jay can address that better than I could. What typical would be. We see a lot of dairies in Nebraska that are in that 200 to 2,000 cow range. Those would be probably most of ours. And those that are very small, of course, it's on a per cow basis. So,
one interaction that we had with one lender said that in their portfolio of dairies, the losses ran from $36 per cow per month to more than $150 per cow per month. Someone says, and this is the last question, and then we're going to move on to Jay, and we'll come back and have some other questions later. It says, in our state, we are finding there are not the extension or other like people to give the kind of assistance that you talk about providing. So where do producers go if they cannot afford to hire someone and the free help isn't there?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. You know, extension has changed throughout the United States. There was a time when our extension staff was dramatically larger than it is now as well. We're down to probably two or three people that would have any capability of being of any assistance right now. I don't know what state that would be. If they would individually want to get to me, I could possibly put them in touch with someone if I happen to know someone in that state. But there are not that many alternatives in some areas, and I certainly understand that's not a good situation.
It's one of the reasons we're having this, to see if we can galvanize some interest around and maybe think about some different ways and alternatives to supply some support for the families. My own experience is that there's often a lot of discussion about the industry and solutions for the industry, and but the solutions for the family are often more difficult to come by. I'd like to shift to Jay Gordon, and Jay also was a collaborator with us on our Farm Family Support Network. The Washington Dairy Federation was a sponsor, working with us on that, and so I've had the privilege of working with Jay on and off for the last few years. Not only is he executive director of the Washington State Dairy Federation, which is the legislative watchdog for most of Washington's dairy producers, he also operates a 130-cow dairy near Elma, Washington, that is transitioning to organic production. And I think these two roles provide Jay a really good foundation to talk to us today. So, Jay, we've heard a bit about the dairy industry already. The floor is yours.
Thank you, John. Again, my name is Jay Gordon. I've been the exec for the Dairy Federation here in Warden for just right at 10 years now. Prior to that, I worked with the association as a volunteer and on the board in a number of areas, worked in conservation districts for about 10 years as a volunteer. My wife and I and a bunch of good people that work with me, a partner on my farm that lets me do this job, allow me the opportunity to both do this policy side, but also we have about a 700-acre, and actually we've converted completely to organic over the last dozen years now. Just an opportunity that came up here on the West Coast for a lot of our smaller mid-size dairies. So a couple things. First, wanted to answer a question that came up earlier just to kind of get it out of the way. One of the questions was, you know, where do you turn and where does a producer turn? That's been a challenge for us. And as John mentioned, a number of years ago, the apple industry had started an organization called Family Farm Support Network in Washington. And after 9/11, when we had the dairy prices really drop dramatically, we jumped on board and supported that organization. It gave us an opportunity to put together, I think we had four financial farm counselors that were basically on-call volunteers. They did have some money to help pay for their time when they were out helping the families. I think there was a couple of mental health counseling or health counseling. And for a few short years, we actually had a place to turn. State got into some budget crunches, and we lost the grant funding that had initially started it, and that organization kind of went into deep hibernation and has not been functioning. And it really is one of the things that, for me as an exec, I feel a little shorthanded. In 02, we had a couple, it was actually the farm wives, we had a couple of farm wives that we had gotten word, you know, were making some statements that were a bit concerning as far as suicide, and we were able to get them some help with our Dairy Women organization. Basically, we just got a couple of tips and called a couple of farm wives that are also nurses and said, you know, I think you need to bake some cookies and get up and talk to your neighbor. But that's, you know, that wasn't good enough, and this Family Farm Support Network did put together, you know, a place where we could call, a place that we could send producers to say, here, they're going to walk through the exercise that you just really heard. You know, what are your options? What are your choices? There is life without farming is one of the options. There is, do you want to stay in farming? Can you stay in farming? And missing that tool has been, for me, just really nerve-wracking this year, because I get up every morning and when I go to bed at night, if nobody's called, said, you know, we've got a suicide, I'm happy, but I'd really rather have a place where we could, like Nebraska, have an opportunity to send producers. And I think it's one of the things in the United States that we're really missing is, I've seen the Nebraska website, I believe there's an Ohio Ohio or Iowa also have a group, but it's a little unnerving. We have a few banks. Farm Credit has been able to do a little bit of help. We have a couple other banks that specialize in ag lending that are able to help, you know, with some financial analysis in a crisis. But going to your bank with a financial crisis is not usually the first choice for a producer. So I think we're really missing that. We're missing the opportunity here that 2,600 farm families using that service in Nebraska just blew me away. So with that, I'm going to focus mostly on dairy, exclusively on dairy. I understand more about dairy by far than anywhere else. This will be West Coast and in particular Northwest, some degree centric, but going to try and talk about kind of where we are and what's happened. And so really starting about a year ago in the dairy industry, we saw dairy prices starting to collapse. We could see the crash coming. The stock market obviously was the first thing, you know, that started to bring the world economy down, U.S. economy down. We had had some very good prices. Producers got the signal, turn on the gas, and let's go. The world needs milk. I remember my days in college where some extension or professor patted me on the head and said, you're a brilliant young man, the world will need food. And for 25 years, we went, well, the world needs food, but nobody can pay us for it. And really, I think dairy, you know, obviously the corn and soybeans and, you know, everything just skyrocketed, and it felt like finally American dairy farmers and American farmers were there. The world could pay us for our products, and it was fun to farm for a while. But those high prices led to low prices. New Zealand and Australia came out of their drought. The dollar started to strengthen. So we didn't have the competitive advantage on the world market that we had. The economic crunch really started to hit last winter. In early January last year, the Europeans went back to, on dairy at least, I don't know about the other commodities, but on dairy, the Europeans voted to go back to a fairly high subsidy on their dairy products. They had expanded their quota and allowed their producers to produce some more milk again for that growing world demand. And when the demand started shrinking, they went back to a subsidy program that is legal under WTO. But nevertheless, it makes our products look pretty sad when you get to the retail or the wholesale level, and you're out there, you know, knocking on doors in the Asian market or in the other markets for dairy products. And so those combinations really resulted in a very dramatic crash in the prices, and it happened very quick. And anybody that's dairy farming knows that milk check went from looking pretty good in November, December last year to looking really ugly by starting in February and March. And so this next slide really shows that's been our life. It looks a bit like a roller coaster, I think. And you'll notice that this slide doesn't stop with where we are today. We're sitting right in here in late 2009. Shows we're going to get a little bit of an uptick. Today's market shows we're at 1285 on class 3. Next month shows we're at 1439. So hopefully we're actually maybe a little early on this upcycle. This was a price projection that Cornell had done basically an update on a model they had done for some policy proposals that counterparts in mine in California had done. And so if you look, it shows that, next spring, according to this model anyway, it looks like we're going to be back into some pretty good prices. So that question that was raised earlier about do I hang on to my equity and get out, or do I see if I can hang on, has been the question that's plagued really the dairy industry across the United States for the last 4, 5, 6 months is, hey, if I just hang on, it looks like good prices are coming. I've got enough equity to survive. And while my neighbor might not make it, I will. And I'm committed to being in this industry. And so I'm going to just hang on until I see this wave coming where we've got price increases again. Looks like another 2 years out, we're going to go through the same wonderful downturn. We as dairy producers have an incredible ability to turn on milk. Sex Semen has added a baseline increase on our heifer numbers. We've got excellent producers left in this industry. Anybody that's been in this business understands there's a program called Cooperative Working Together, which is CWT for short, is an industry-funded supply management where the producers, about 70% of the producers across the United States, put a dime per hundredweight into a kitty that, when we have too much milk, it's used to offer producers a chance to sell their cows and send their cows to slaughter. That program has been used, I believe, 7 times, and I think I heard a rumor that yesterday they may have announced another herd buyout, rumor only. But what that's done is, you know, for farmers, when you have a salesman knock on your door 6 or 7 times and ask, hey, how'd you like to get out of the business? By the 6th or 7th time the salesman comes around and knocks on your door and you've told him no, you're pretty much sure you really want to stay in the industry. And I think that's the other thing that's changed is we have producers that are committed. They've made the decision to stay in this industry. They've had opportunities that are very good opportunities to get out through CWT. And they've said, we want to stay in. We want our kids to have an opportunity. We're going to invest in our infrastructure and our cows and our dairies, and we're going to be one of the tough ones that survive. And so we have some very, very tough, determined producers left in this industry that want to be in our industry. And so it does tend to make for a bit of a question of how do we constrain growth when we are in a shrinking market like we have for the last, really about 12 months now. We're in a world market as well, and I think the ag in uncertain times, I think the challenge and the struggle that we've had in the dairy industry, certainly for the last year, but probably since the post 9/11 crash in the dairy market, is that we're in a world market. And I don't think the United States dairy industry and the United States policies that we have got that date back to the Great Depression are really sufficient tools for dealing with that world market. The slide here is a bit of a hodgepodge. Apologize for it. This is a website that I found cruising around yesterday from New Zealand or from Australia, and I just was struck by how much both it was similar to the complaints by the Australian farmers, but it also had several headlines. They were paying very close attention to our Cooperative Working Together program. How much product is up here in the United States that's weighing down the world market? What is the Europeans going to do? We're doing the same thing. We're looking at what the Europeans are doing. How's Argentina doing? What's Australia doing? Is somebody having a drought somewhere? So this is a world market today that really creates a different bug. When we peaked, I believe, in about June of 2008 on our exports, I believe we were pushing right at 10, 11% of all milk produced in the United States was going for the export market. That had traditionally always been in the 4 or 5% range. And with that world demand, weak dollar, the world said, we'd like to have your milk. And the United States, which has mostly domestic policies for dairy, was suddenly, okay, green light, we'll send the milk to Vietnam or Korea or China or Saudi Arabia, wherever they're willing to buy it, we're willing to send it at that price. And so this is really one of the big changes that I think we're going to have to recognize in the dairy industry and come up with some tools. And we're having that debate on the policy level right now. So what's next? Obviously, we've got policy discussions. It looks like we've got a recovery coming, finally. We hope. That's the maybe. And so there's some opportunity here this winter. Obviously, we've got some nervous bankers. This has been a pretty tough downturn. It has really hit the equity hard. The thing that's been a bit fascinating is it's been fairly, at least from my perspective, fairly even. You heard the range in losses. In the West, the numbers that we continue to hear through last spring, late last spring and this summer, was typically you can expect a dairy to be losing somewhere between $100 and $150 a cow. And it really, per month, it really didn't seem to matter whether you were milking 200 cows or 4,000 cows. Everybody seems to have adapted over the last 10 or 15 years that's in the industry so that they've got an ability to make money. Efficiency in size, organic, small, a large crop base, whatever their particular niche that has allowed them to stay in this industry now has made the industry fairly consistent in their cost structures. And so we don't see the gap that we saw in the 80s and the 90s where the little guys that didn't have the efficiencies of the large guys were the first to go out and help get the supply and demand back in balance. Everybody seems to be generally on about the same price structure for cost of production. And so it has allowed everybody to really look around and go, okay, I'm going to stay in, I'm going to bleed on equity here, and I'm going to outlast you because that strategy has worked well for the last dozen years. But what it has made is an interesting scenario where everybody's bleeding equity, waiting for this recovery to occur. And I can tell you the bankers are nervous, and I think there's going to be some changes on how things happen. Obviously, there's been a fair bit of national policy discussions. I'll get into that next, whether it's at National Milk or the House and the Senate have got competing bills. Those policy discussions, obviously, option number one is really just, tweak the existing programs that have been around, by and large, since the mid-30s. The support program, CCC purchasing, Dairy Export Incentive Program, or DEEP, was added in one of the farm bills dozen and a half years ago. Those programs have worked well. Didn't work too well for this downturn, but obviously that's still an option. There's a deregulation, I'll frame it deregulation, that's not exactly accurate, but it's certainly reducing the regulation and trying to allow the market. I think the theory behind this NMPF plan that was released in concept about a week ago is really to take a look at that dairy price support program, the MILC program. There's a concept, and I don't have any details on this second small bullet there, on a dairy producer income insurance program. I do not have the details on that, and I'm looking forward to hearing what that means. Is that a program like the milk income or the livestock gross margin program? I don't have a lot of details out of that. I do know, at least I think I was talking to a producer in Minnesota the other day, and they've had some discussions on this up at Foremost. So looking forward to hearing what that is. Obviously, the Cooperatives Working Together program has worked well. The question that I think all of us have is, can it continue to work for two reasons? One is the sex semen has created the ability to produce a lot more heifers in our industry than we need. And the second is, I think what we're seeing this last 7, 8, 9 months is the United States is balancing the rest of the world. The United States doesn't have a quota system like Canada or the EU. It's not a low-cost producer like Australia or New Zealand. We're in the middle. And it really feels like the United States needed to balance the world supply of milk, and we took a lot of that. And I will give Cooperative CWT program a huge amount of credit for doing that. But I think that was a huge challenge that they're still struggling. Have we gotten enough cows out of the system to balance both the U.S. and also the shrink in the international demand for our product and the world in general? I've got a link there for the press release to the NMPF plan. Third set of options kind of floating around what I would call the supply management options. There was a Specter Casey bill introduced last May, which was fairly similar to a bill in 07, Senate Bill 889. It has a fair bit of support from, I would say, the New England area, Pennsylvania. There's been two additional plans at least come to mind lately. USA Holstein, or Holstein USA, got on board with a group called Milk Producers Council, one of our trade associations out here in the West, out of California. The growth management plan that MPC had worked on for a number of years intrigued Holstein, and for a while they were working very strongly and together to promote this concept. There's been a slight there's a slight change in their proposals lately, but by and large they're both basic concepts of how do we create an ability to control growth so that we don't end up with the you know, 1 foot on the gas and then 10 minutes later we've got 1 foot on the brake. How do we put some incentives in place to do that? A side note, as I'm an organic producer with Organic Valley, that co-op, which has a fairly unique ability to nationwide tell all of us that are owners in the company, slow down, we have too much product. Their board in May said we need to do a 7% reduction in production nationwide, and 6 weeks later it took effect. The United States dairy industry doesn't have that ability. Well, obviously it does have the ability. There's 69 co-ops in the United States through the Kapper-Volstead Act. They could get together and do exactly the same thing. About 85% of the milk in the United States goes through those co-ops. And certainly those co-ops through Kapper-Volstead could get together, but politically getting that many co-ops to agree would be very difficult. Organic Valley had, you know, a unique opportunity with a fairly significant portion of the national organic milk, and it was able to drop its production across the board, across the United States, by about 7% in 6 weeks. And so it was a nice model. It'd be nice to see if we can come up with something similar to that, because I think a supply management or a quota system like Canada, it never probably politically going to sell. Okay, let's move on. In politics, obviously, the odds favor no significant changes. Inertia is kind of tough to beat. The programs that we've had in place since the 30s, have served us well, and big change really comes tough. It's one of those things the founding fathers wanted us to have, a slow, cautious, and deliberative democracy, and boy, have we created that. It at times becomes frustrating, but we have a lot of people to talk to, a lot of producers, a lot of families around the country that have been in the dairy industry, and they want to know what's next. And so really, how do we put together some tools to try and deal with these challenges that we've seen over the last 7, 8, 9 years of very high volatility, highs and lows that just are gut-wrenching at times like now. And so I'm going to punt a little bit on, I don't really think there's probably an opportunity, certainly not with the milk prices heading back up now. I think the political pressure to do something, right, wrong, or indifferent, the political pressure to do something on these policy proposals is probably going to fade as the milk prices come up. But those milk prices will go back down again. And so I think point number two is the one that's probably the take home. The risk management, I think, becomes much more important. If I had to look out next 6, 8, 10 months for the grain industry, you guys have learned how to manage using forward contracting and protect yourselves The dairy industry has dabbled in it. I've had a lot of producers have used it, but I wouldn't say it's a majority by any stretch of the imagination. I would suspect that we're going to see bankers become more interested in helping their clients use risk management as a way to protect themselves. I think we're going to see an opportunity to lock in a decent margin. It may even be there today. We're going to put on a fairly couple hours of workshops at our annual meeting at the end of this month to help producers understand, particularly the livestock gross margin program, and see if we can make sure that our producers understand tools and the choices that they can have, and really start to learn to use some of those livestock or risk management tools. Because really, again, the point number one, I'd like to hope that we could come to consensus in the United States as a dairy industry and create some new tools for dealing with this world market. But I just don't see consensus is tough in the dairy industry. We're pretty independent. I think we're going to have to come up with something different.
Thank you, Jay.
Okay. What do you think is going to cause the major increase in followed by the major decrease so fast in that sense of that graph you had?
Probably just the fact that the dairy industry in the United States has got we just have very good producers that know how to turn milk on. You know, when we saw soybeans and corn, soybeans in the 10 plus range and corn in the $5-6 a bushel range, started to see producers use less BST, started to see them use tighter rations, balance for slightly less milk. And so just little, when you've got 50,000 families all making the same decisions to either turn on the gas or put their foot on the brake, we've got very good producers left in this industry that have you give them a market signal that says make money, or right now you can make money. And I think probably the most dramatic thing will be this, you know, these prices at $14, $15, $16, $17 a hundredweight, there's producers who are going to be able to make good money and plug those equity holes that they've dug themselves into. And it's going to be, the signal is everybody go, green light. And so I think you'll see a fairly, I actually think that Cornell model graph probably is a little optimistic. I would suspect we can turn on milk production much faster than that graph shows. And I think that the crash is going to occur, if I have to crystal ball it, I'd say the crash is going to come quicker because we don't have the tools to turn off the milk production. Everybody, there's a rule in dairy. When the price of milk goes up, make more milk. When the price of milk goes down, you make more milk. And it doesn't necessarily make sense, but you try and outrun the cash flow by making more milk when prices are down, and you try and make as much money as you can when the prices are up. And collectively, we just don't have a decision, have a way to turn that faucet down. 4-6% is all we need to reduce milk production. Every producer I've talked to has said, I'd love to be able to, if everybody would cut back 4-5%, I'd love to be able to do that. But a pile of producers have said, where we don't have consensus is, well, the only way for everybody to do that is through a government program or a government-managed program or a government-sponsored program like the checkoff program that we've got where you had a board, and we don't have that. We could also do it through cooperative action like we have done through CWT, but getting consensus of 69 co-ops and 40,000 producers across the United States has made that, at least so far, not possible, other than CWT, which has just been exceptional. It's been, I'm not disparaging that at all. But we turn a faucet on, but individually, we all have the ability to turn a faucet high. We just can't constrain it.
One more quick question then.
Do you have any advice or resources you can give to help new or beginning producers?
Today, I think there's an opportunity to take a look if, and hopefully they're in a state where they have the livestock gross margin. I don't know a lot about the program. I'm certainly not selling it But again, I think as my last point mentioned, I think that ability to lock in a margin for the next 6-8 months, a year, looks fairly good. It's going to take a bit of education on how that's going to work and if it's going to work for their place. But, you know, $10 milk is a sure way to guarantee, if you're a new producer, that you just don't have the resources and the equity to lean on. And that's the game that we've played in the dairy industry for the last really 20, 30 years now, is lean on equity in a tough time. You know, obviously, I think there's, if you're in a place where you can take advantage of some of the, if a smaller producer, if you can take advantage of some of the niche markets, direct marketing, either fluid or cheese, organic right now is by and large closed. The national market has shrunk on that one. And so there may be some niche-y stuff that is available. But I think other than that.
Okay. I'm going to turn this over to John again. Jay, I'm going to ask you to mute your microphone. John, go ahead.
I'm here. At the beginning of your presentation, you answered a question from earlier, Jay, about where folks can turn and frustration of not having a place. This price-cost squeeze that happened, and as you look around, is there 5%, 15% of dairy producers, 20% that are in, experience some really, I would say, really difficult financial stress?
I would have to say I think if you ask most producers today, what's their financial situation? It is not good. Frankly, it surprised me we've not had more producers leave the industry in the last 2-4 months. It just really stuns me how tough these guys are and gals. If these milk prices had not come up here in October, November, December, it'd have been pretty nasty.
We had a presenter on last month and didn't have quite as optimistic a view of dairy as that chart showed, and is actually talking about the need, probably their projections were for another 100,000 cows to go out of the nation's dairy herd before they saw any balance between supply and demand. So kind of following up on that, what the buyout programs, are those stopgap measures? Do they do you think they are a real help in a longer-term solution?
That very question is being asked by the National Milk Board, or CWT Board. It's worked well. Third time I've said it. The CWT is a stunning success, no matter how you do it. I raise sweet corn and peas and beans and various other specialty crops on my farm, and I think that the American farmer has had the Capra-Volstead Act since the 1920s, and really the CWT to have had 70% of the American dairy farmers through their cooperatives participate in a program to control supply and demand is the first, as far as I know, and only nationwide effort to, a successful effort to use the Capra-Volstead provisions to band together and control supply. That being said, it faces some very tough challenges, whether it can remain one of the only tools for controlling supply collectively, because of the ability of sex semen to add cows. Because it's a world market now, the Canadians don't have this problem. The Europeans still have a quota system. Australia and New Zealand can undercut our price no matter what. They are still a low-cost producer. They're a very small percentage of the world market, but especially New Zealand can undercut the price. They can produce milk cheaper than the United States. We're a fairly efficient producer in the world. The United States is really once you get beyond Australia, New Zealand, and maybe India, the United States is 25% of the world milk production, and it's really the lower tier of milk producers. So our dairymen are very efficient. So when the world needs balanced, we're the big chunk of milk that takes. New Zealand is going to hang on to their market because they can produce cheaper than we can. The next level of market supply, the next level of supply for the world is the United States dairy industry. And so we sort of become the buyer of first choice when there's a shortage and the buyer of last choice when there's a surplus, or seller of last choice. They just don't want our milk when the prices are, or when demand shrinks. So we end up getting kind of whipsawed. CWT it's asking an awful lot of CWT and, 40,000 dairymen to try and balance the world supply of milk. That's a tough
one. Yeah, thank you. Dave, if you can turn your mic back on here, we've got a couple of follow-up questions for you. One of them is how important is it to have both, all parties involved in the initial meeting to get all the facts on the table, or is it better to work with individuals separately?
Well, it's the answer, I think, that is always easy to give. It depends, and it does depend. But it's nice to have as many people there as possible. That's not always a luxury that you're going to have. But, especially if it's a decision-making time. In that initial meeting, it's probably not as crucial, but in order to get all the information on the table, I think it's important to have as many parties there as possible. A lot of decisions aren't made based on the numbers. In fact, most of them probably aren't. Most of the decisions are made on these other things, emotions or personal interactions or other items. So it's a nice luxury to have as many people there as possible.
And what are the signs of working with a family or an individual that, if they aren't really verbal, about that there's assistance needed? And what are the three key things you might recommend that we watch for?
Let me get some clarification what you're asking here, and maybe you don't know either, but signs that there's problems within the family, signs that there's rephrase that a little bit for me, would you?
Well, I'm going to interpret the person who put the question up, because it came from someone else, and I'm just going to say signs that they're working with some really significant financial stress and whatever other issues that might be causing.
Okay. All right. Well, one of the things I think comes up a lot is when people are emotional, you'll see situations where you have a 60, 70-year-old man, and he starts to cry. That's a pretty good clue that something's wrong. It's a clue that you probably need to follow up with some other resources. If there's a lot of problems making a decision, it's when we have a stressful situation, we kind of have this overwhelming amount of stimulus that's coming from all different directions, and it's hard to sort out what the pertinent information is versus the other information. If you're seeing individuals that are having a huge amount of difficulty in sorting out the pertinent information and making some even basic decisions, that's probably another sign. A lot of anger, excessive anger, is another one I think that shows up a lot. It's one of those signs of grief, the anger stage. And I think in many ways, it's like, if it goes beyond just a problem and ends up being a situation where the individual is actually getting out the business, I think you can look at those stages of grief just like losing a loved one. I think that there's some similarities to that. So those would be at least some of the factors I think that I watch for.
I can still remember when we invited yourself and the individuals working with you.
Deb Rude.
Deb Rude.
It was Deb Rude, right.
To consult with us about the Establish the Farm Family Support Network. And there was a statement you made the very first meeting that I think I still remembered accurately, and I'd like you to comment on a little. And it was one of the things we learned from the 80s was that the families that found themselves caught in really difficult situations came out the other side more healthy, better, whatever the indication was, if they faced the reality of their situation head on, so that they then could create their plan. Do you think that still applies?
Oh, I sure do. You know, sometimes, you know, this is, you know, I don't want to get into being a psychologist here, but I think that when you're faced with a squeeze, a financial situation, a lot of stress, that, you know, the frustration or the fear of it has to do with not being in control or having a total loss of control. And if you can get to the situation where you're helping people at least make their own decisions, not letting someone else, be it a lender or a family member or whomever it might be, making all the decisions, I think you put them back in control. And I know one of the very first families that I worked with back 25 years ago, almost now, I guess it was, they made the decision to leave the farm. And it was a hard decision for them. They looked at all the alternatives, but after they sat down and had a heart-to-heart with each other and you know, with our help and work through it, they decided to leave the farm. I saw them about 5 years after that, and they made the comment that, you know, this was the best decision we ever made. And, you know, maybe the solution to the situation would not be help everybody stay on necessarily, but it goes back to that point I made in my presentation about you really need to help people identify what's important to them and help them make the decision based on who they are and what their situation is.
Well, I'd like to, we've had some other questions come in. We've run out of time. I really want to thank Dave and Jay for some very informative, insightful presentations. Before I move right on, the slide that you have up there, if there's, and I see one of the other comments that someone put in, which we will pick it up and look at it, is some other suggestions of other depth and detail that we might go into. So we did get that. But if you have some other suggestions for us, and it's not on next week's marketing strategies, I'm sorry, we didn't get this slide change. It's really families facing uncertainty in agriculture for the next couple of weeks, because we've got another set of really good presenters coming up next week. Clinical psychologist, individual that's worked a great deal with farm and ranch families around communication issues, and another person on balancing personal and business financial issues. So if you want to include some information over there in the chat box in the left, or send those to our email at westrme@wsu.edu. When the question came up earlier about who and where people should go, and Jay had mentioned he'd been out on the web and he'd found two or three. Well, one of the persons that's with the Iowa Concern Hotline is on our webinar today and has given us their 800 number, and even though many of us aren't in Iowa, they've said, please call them, and maybe they can provide some ideas and thoughts. And I'll just give you that number. I don't have the capability to type it up, but it's 800-447-1985. Again, that's for the Iowa Concern Hotline, and I'm sure you could probably Google that as well. That's 800-447-1985. It's also listed on our wiki for our farmmanagement.org, which is wiki.farmmanagement.org. And thank you very much. I don't have that individual's name, but it's someone with that Iowa Concern Hotline, and we know that Iowa has had a program for a number of years working with farm and ranch families. So you can drag this file that's there on your screen. You can click on the Save to My Computer. You can bring that. It's got these websites listed right on it. Save those so you don't have to have tried to copy them down. But again, our thanks to Dave and Jay for getting us off to a good start on this webinar series. We invite you to join us next Wednesday morning when we'll cover in some more detail communications issues. We know that it's not just farm and ranch families, but when other families face really stressful times, that what is often true is that communication is the first thing to go, and it's one of the things that's most needed. And so Elaine will be here to visit with us. One of the, I think Dave mentioned it, one of the complicating factors, it's a little different today, is that people have had the capacity to run up some significant debt on the personal side with their credit cards, often to help finance the business. And so the bleed over between the personal and the business finances creates some complications when working through some of those issues. And we're going to think a little bit about some of those issues. And then we also have a clinical psychologist whose business is working with farm and ranch families around mental and other kinds of health issues. So join us next Wednesday, same time, 9 o'clock. And thank you very much for all of you for joining us this morning. We'll see you next week.